other security branches, military security branches that contain vital evidence. And so these strikes are also adding to the quite, you know, upsetting situation that we currently find ourselves in terms of just preserving evidence, making sure that someday, you know, hopefully every family can learn what, you know, what the fate of their loved ones had been and where they may have been buried, and to really be able to give them a decent burial.
Heba Zayadeen, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Senior Middle East and North Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. She's just returned from Syria. That does it for our show. You can watch our show on podcast, video, and audio. See our transcripts at democracynow.org and get our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Anjali Comet, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Ozbeck. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, where we bring you a range of community-oriented programming built by community members like you. Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st so we can bring you another great year of cutting-edge radio made by you for you. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to contribute today.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, an historic revamp for Portland as 12 new city council members, a new auditor, and a new mayor take their oaths of office, express their thanks, and talk about the new direction for the city. A longtime Multnomah County commissioner saying goodbye after calling attention to issues like houselessness and drug addiction. And a goodbye to a murderous insect that targeted beneficial bugs in the Northwest. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 19th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Minette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
I will support the Constitution
of the United States,
and of the State of Oregon,
and the Charter of the City of Portland,
and its laws.
I will faithfully, honestly, and ethically
perform my duties as councilor of the City of Portland.
And with that, 12 new members of the Portland City Council were sworn in. They all gave brief remarks, starting with Candace Avalos from District 1.
Good afternoon, Portland! Today is a moment of great significance, not just for me, not just for Portland, but specifically for District 1. That's right. Let's hear it. As your new city councilor, I stand before you humbled by the trust you have placed in me and resolute in my commitment to justice, equity, and accountability. East Portland is a vibrant, diverse community with untapped potential, yet for too long it has been underserved.
I'm Jamie Dunphy. I'm incredibly honored to have been chosen by my neighbors to represent my community of East Portland. East Portland has never had a seat at the table, and on January 2nd, we're going to have three. East Portland is filled with amazing, hardworking people who just want tomorrow to be a little bit better than yesterday was.
My name is Loretta Smith, and I am so excited to be one of your new 12 city commissioners. The reason why I ran was because Ada, Malaya, and Jordan Jr. I am their grandmother, and I want them to live in a city that works for everybody. I want to make sure that they're not just surviving here in the city of Portland. I want them to thrive.
My name's Samir Canal. I'm one of the councilor-elects for District 2, North and Northeast Portland. I never thought I'd be the first at anything. And being the first Indian American city councilor over 100 years after our community first established themselves in what is now Portland, and joining my colleague Tiffany Koyama Lane as the first two Asian American counselors in Portland's history. It's an honor and it's a responsibility beyond words.
I'm thinking about the five women up here with me today, elected to Portland's new city council, and the fact that there have only been 10 women ever who have served on the Portland City Council or as mayor of our city. And at the start of January, half of our new council will be female. Portland, we have heard your call for change.
My hope is that all of us will remember those conversations we had on porches, in parks, on the sidewalks this past campaign. We had more opportunity to get out and talk to people.
I'm a public school teacher. I'm Yonsei, fourth generation Japanese American. I'm a community organizer, and I am a champion for my students, their families, and the working class.
Last to take the stage and be sworn in was the new mayor, Keith Wilson.
I will faithfully, honestly, and ethically perform my duties as mayor of the city of Portland.
Perform my duties of the mayor of Portland.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
What a great honor. Congratulations. And to all of my new partners, to the counselors of 12 extraordinary people that I've become to learn and to really admire, extraordinary leaders, ladies and gentlemen, Portland, we're very honored and grateful to have you join us. And I do want to thank the transition team. And Dan, Ryan, and I know there's a lot of firsts on this stage, but have we ever had two Roosevelt graduates gracing our city leadership? So Councilor Ryan and I are so throw down on that one. So thank you all for this. And to the extraordinary transition team, the city government, the city staff, thank you to Mr. Selby, Judge Ortega, and Mayor Wheeler. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler, for your kind words, your counsel, and your dedication to the city of Portland. I couldn't be more grateful and humbled for the honor of serving the city that has given me so very much. Portland has reached a long-awaited moment of transformation and promise. Our city government has been reimagined, embodying the best of our innovation and values. Our new electoral system rewards consensus and bridge building over ideology and division. Our new city council is more diverse and representative than any that came before. By enacting these reforms, Portland made a once-in-generation investment in the future. Now, it's time for Portland's new leadership to meet the moment we now face and solve the issues that prevent us from reaching our true potential.
And that was the swearing-in of Keith Wilson, Portland's new mayor. Meantime, a longtime leader on the Multnomah County Commission had to say goodbye this week. County Commissioner Sharon Myron, an emergency room doctor and lawyer, has served 8 years, so due to term limits, she can't run for another consecutive term.
It's not just homelessness alone. It's not just addiction or mental health or our criminal justice system or public safety or community justice. It's all of those things together.
She's often been the voice of criticism about the county's approaches to homelessness and addiction.
Bring a sense of urgency to the work of the county.
This week, she gave a farewell address.
We've been through so much, including racial reckonings and global pandemics and homelessness that is so profound and harm so many people. Commissioner Julia Brim Edwards and others credit her for training other leaders.
You pressure tested my ideas.
Bringing expertise they didn't have, especially during the pandemic.
You explained to me what sobering was and what it wasn't. You bluntly told me when I had a bad idea or I was heading in the wrong direction. You were like my, hey Siri, and then fill in the blank with a complicated question about the county, healthcare, homelessness, traumatic brain injury, addiction services, systems performance, veterans. And I would get this answer back that would be in layperson's language, that was very responsive, factual, and actually pointed me towards how I could take actions or how I could make something better.
Tributes to Myron included this from the Oregon Health Authority's Ebony Clark.
What you brought to the table was accountability. What you brought to the table was examples of what it means to be more than a manager. You have always asked hard questions.
The ER doctor and lawyer served during a tough 8 years on the Multnomah County Commission.
You are more than just an elected official. You are a humanitarian.
Due to term limits, she has to leave the commission to new leadership and says many issues remain unsolved.
When we started, I came in the ER seeing the opioid crisis. And at that point, it was prescription opioids. And that's what I'd been working on. I was saying, what about that meth? It's really bad. We need to be doing something. Then fentanyl, really potent and bad. And it's just been so many steps along this path. Make it about the people we serve, the people on the front line doing the work, the people living in our county. And as new board members are coming on that actually know the work on the front line, they can carry in their heart and soul moving forward.
And that was from a tribute to Sharon Myron, who has served on the Multnomah County Commission and is walking away after 8 years. The murder hornet, the largest example of the hornet species, is no more in the Pacific Northwest. KBOO's Josh Salem reports.
The Washington and U.S. Departments of Agriculture announced murder hornets have been eradicated in the U.S., 5 years after being spotted for the first time in Washington state. There have actually been no sightings in Washington since 2021. This all followed a complicated program in which residents placed traps on their properties and reported sightings, and researchers engaged in capturing live hornets, then attaching tiny radio tracking tags with dental floss and following the insects to their nests. Scientists then aimed to destroy the nests when the queens were just beginning to emerge. Sven Spieschiger, pest program manager of the Washington State Department of Agriculture, said, quote, I've got to tell you, as an entomologist, I've been doing this for over 25 years now, and it is a rare day when the humans actually get to win one against the insects, end quote. The hornets can be up to 2 inches long and were formerly called Asian giant hornets. In 2013, they killed 42 people in China and seriously injured 1,675 in the U.S. They were first detected in North America in British Columbia in August of 2019 and were found in Washington State in December of the same year. Murder hornets can wipe out a honeybee hive in as little as 90 minutes, decapitating the bees and then taking over the hive, feeding their own young on the bees. A Washington beekeeper reported hives being attacked, and they turned in specimens of murder hornets in the summer of 2020. Experts think the hornets could have traveled to North America in plant pots or shipping containers. Interestingly, DNA evidence suggests the insects found in British Columbia and Washington were not related, and that they originated from different countries. The hornet can sting through most beekeeper suits, deliver almost 7 times the amount of venom as a honeybee, and sting multiple times. At one point, the Washington Agriculture Department ordered special reinforced suits from China. Washington is the only state that has had confirmed reports of murder hornets. Trappers found 4 nests in 2020 and 2021. There have been no confirmed reports in British Columbia since 2021, and the hornet is also considered eradicated there. Spieschiger said, though, Washington will remain on the lookout despite the eradication. Entomologists will continue to monitor traps in Kitsap County because of an unconfirmed sighting in October. Other invasive hornets can also pose problems, like the yellow-legged hornet in the southeastern U.S. Overall, around 72 people a year die from bee and hornet stings, according to the National Institutes of Health. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
They're breaking ground on affordable housing for farm workers in Oregon.
where the housing shortage impacts the more than 66,000 farmworker households in a very big way. As Isabel Charlet reports, one nonprofit's working to change that by creating affordable and energy-efficient homes.
Construction will begin early next year on new affordable housing dedicated to low-income Oregon farmworkers. This project is the latest by the Farmworker Housing Development Corporation, a nonprofit that is partnering with Energy Trust of Oregon to make their housing more energy-efficient. This year, the FHDC hosted workshops teaching more than 200 families how to save energy at home. Ramon Martinez with the corporation says the payoffs are significant. Along with receiving more than $20,000 in incentives to help reduce energy use across their properties, he says residents' bills are down.
During the cold months, some people are afraid to turn on the heater, right? But it's been great because I've heard successful stories about residents seeing $200, $300 bills, lowering it down to the $100 range.
Research shows that most farm workers in Oregon do not have access to affordable housing and often live in overcrowded conditions. In Oregon and Washington, 32% of farm worker households live in poverty, which is more than twice as much as the general U.S. population. The Farmworker Housing Development Corporation manages 460 units across the central Willamette Valley, providing affordable housing to more than 2,000 people. Along with rental housing, it also helps farm workers who are interested in becoming homeowners. Christian Menez-Sorita with the corporation says it has hosted homebuyer resource fairs and recently started a fund to help farm workers find housing and pay for education.
Our affordable housing options can be a stepping stone.
Menez-Sorita says more information about the Ramon Ramirez Fund can be found at its website, fhdc.org. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden met for a town hall meeting with members of the Oregon League of Conservation Voters this afternoon and talked about the fights he anticipates in the coming years with the incoming Trump administration.
We've had another hard year. Wildfires, heat, people lining up their go bags, trying to think about getting out the door on a moment's notice. Ice storms, the alarm bells ring loud and clear in our state. And I'm very proud that I was able to finally break 50 years worth of gridlock on climate change. For 50 years, there had not been a cap and trade bill. There had not been a carbon fee. There hadn't been any meaningful regulatory action. And back in 2010, the cap and trade bill went down in the House, and a lot of climate champions actually gave up at that point, literally said, we can't do it. We can't even get a hearing in the United States Senate after it passed the cap and trade bill in the House. And I said, I didn't get an election certificate to give up. And I basically went up into the attic for about a year, and I said, I think I got a way to advance the cause. And that is basically taking the federal tax code and the energy provisions and throwing them in the garbage can. And we didn't get all the way there. We got pretty damn close. And it has generated hundreds of billions of dollars in smart climate investment, solar and wind and geothermal and hydro. And we're just getting started. But we know we face a rearguard action from Donald Trump, who actually campaigned on rolling back some of those provisions. Yep. And by the way, these were carrots, not sticks. They were market-oriented. We said the more you reduce carbon, the bigger your tax savings. They were technologically neutral so as to reward good science. And one of the things I'm a little bit encouraged by in these very challenging times is 18 Republican House members have already told their leadership that they don't want to see those tax incentives rolled back. I already almost lost my voice because the chairman of the Finance Committee, we're dealing with healthcare, we're dealing with taxes. We got a lot on our plate, but using your voice for this cause is a labor of love.
I remember the town halls we were having with you when we were trying to get the Inflation Reduction Act passed, the largest, most historic piece when it comes to climate investments ever in the world. And to know that got done now, obviously, I don't think would have happened. And the clean energy tax credits in particular, I know how you are the expert on that, and you're really why that happened. I am obviously a little worried about what happens now. And curious on how you think we can all work to defend both IRA and all the different pieces, but also here in Oregon, we've been awarded hundreds of millions of dollars that are critical for our, like our climate action plans, things that help us expand on who can access a heat pump, EVs, and a lot of other things, and solar. And what? How do we make sure that funding that's been awarded but not yet arrived really does make it to Oregon?
What I'm trying to do is build on things like those eight Republican legislators who have said, don't mess with the tax credits. What we find is that a lot of these legislators go home, and when there's dedication ceremonies for a battery facility or a geothermal program or something like that, they end up saying, I was happy I was able to help with such and such state program, or I was glad to be part of such and such local program. And then people often raise a hand in the audience and say, but you voted against the clean energy tax credits, which are the primary reason we are here today.
Yeah.
And I think that what we need to do is in Oregon, and I've been urging it across the land with clean energy companies and communities, is we need to get out and we need to assign an activist to every member of Congress, number one, and advocates in the areas where the facilities are located, number two, to localize them, to okay. talk about why right here in community X, people have good jobs, they have a way to, you know, feed their families and pay the rent and maybe once in a while go on a vacation and the kinds of things working people need. And we're getting a good response. But here's the key thing to remember. In January, we don't know what the first offers will be from the Republican leadership. There's a lot of talk. They may start with immigration and energy. And Trump had the drill baby drill effort. So we can't be out there soon enough. We got to start mobilizing, and it needs to be in every community, talking to every member of Congress.
Hello, Senator Wyden. My name's Maroon.
Hey, Maroon. Thanks for participating. You are always a really good environmental advocate.
Yeah, I'm Maroon. I live in the Rogue Valley, and I'm a full-time climate justice organizer. I'm wondering what you will do or what policies you'll work for to make sure Oregon frontline communities who are facing the harshest effects of our ongoing climate emergency are protected from all these extreme weather events. I'm glad to hear that you are pretty familiar with the extreme cold, extreme heat, the record-breaking fires. Many of these trends are due to the increased global emissions from fossil fuel companies, alongside the fact that this year alone, over 650,000 tons of CO2 have been emitted from the ongoing genocide in Palestine, funded by the U.S. What are you going to do to make sure these policies, or what will you do, including policies, to make sure Oregon frontline communities are protected from these concerning trends?
Frontline communities always see the pain first, and invariably it is harder than in communities that are well off. I remember the heat a couple of years ago. We were on our doorstep in Southeast Portland in a community with lots of very well off folks. And I spent the day going out to Lentz, going to visit with people in the community who didn't even have any shade in the neighborhood, and it was just suffocating. And even then we started to get some help for low-income folks in terms of air conditioning systems, and nowhere near enough to attack the problem comprehensively, but at least a decent start. Frontline communities get it first, they get it harder. And if we're serious about tackling climate, you don't leave behind those communities.
You are listening to an end of year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, then at 7, American Indian Airways. Tonight's weather, it'll be cloudy with a slight chance of rain, a low down to 46. Tomorrow will be more cloudy skies, a high of 53. Today in history, on this date in 1998, the House of Representatives approved two articles of impeachment against President Bill Clinton, charging him with lying under oath and obstructing justice. Clinton vowed to and did finish his term. The quote of the day is from Bill Clinton. If you live long enough, you'll make mistakes, but if you learn from them, you'll be a better person. It's how you handle adversity, not how it affects you. House Republicans nix a bipartisan budget agreement at President-elect Donald Trump's urging. Republicans break down the priorities of Trump's first 100 days agenda, and the House Ethics Committee votes to release its report on former Congressman Matt Gaetz. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
The CR is coming together. Bipartisan work is ongoing. We're almost there. We worked really hard to achieve consensus on a bill that responsibly funds the government into March of next year. It'll go to March 14.
Although House Speaker Mike Johnson championed a bipartisan government funding bill, President-elect Donald Trump's disapproval of it sends lawmakers back to the drawing board. GOP House members had their own gripes about the bill, with some saying it kowtows to Democrats. Trump and Vice President-elect J.D. Vance want it to be a clean funding bill without excess provisions, though they want it to include a debt ceiling increase. A partial government shutdown begins Saturday if no budget bill is passed. House Democrats are frustrated with Republicans tossing the bill out. It included disaster relief for people and farms affected by Hurricanes Milton and Helene. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says breaking this agreement signals that Republicans are being ordered to shut down the federal government.
House Republicans will now own any harm that is visited upon the American people that results from a government shutdown or worse.
Meanwhile, Senate Republicans are preparing to hit the ground running during Trump's first 100 days in office. They say key priorities are reducing inflation, cutting federal spending, and implementing Trump's tax cuts. Florida Senator Rick Scott says the first thing they'll address is securing the U.S.-Mexico border.
So what do we need? We need money for more Border Patrol agents. We need more money for ICE agents to do the deportations. We need to have money for the wall, money for vessels, money for technology.
A border bill proposed earlier this year would have supplied more funding for some of these priorities, although at Trump's urging, most Senate Republicans voted against it. During a joint economic committee hearing on President-elect Trump's proposed tariffs, economists spoke about how they impact everyday Americans. Trump has asserted foreigners would bear the brunt of these tariffs, but Ed Gresser with the Progressive Policy Institute says the opposite is true and could have serious consequences.
My view in brief, this would lower American living standards, erode our business competitiveness, and harm our exporters. Depending on the method used, it could also damage U.S. governance and the separation of powers and raise corruption risks.
After a school shooting in Wisconsin, Vice President Kamala Harris and other elected officials are renewing calls to end gun violence and revive gun safety legislation. The Gun Violence Archive has tallied 491 mass shootings this year. Harris says elected leaders must have the courage to act on solutions.
We as a nation must renew our commitment to end the horror of gun violence, both mass shootings and everyday gun violence that touches so many communities in our nation.
The House Ethics Committee voted to release its report on former Congressman Matt Gaetz. The report on the former U.S. Attorney General pick details illicit activities like sexual misconduct allegations, using campaign funds for personal use, and accepting illegal gifts under House rules. Gaetz is denouncing the decision to release the report as a witch hunt against him perpetrated by the Biden administration and the DOJ. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The U.S. Senate passes an Arizona lawmaker's Native American Child Protection Act. And an electricity grid program is empowering Navajo Nation families. For those stories and more, here's Brian Bull in Eugene, Oregon, with National Native News.
An Indian Affairs bill to prevent child abuse appears set to become law after the U.S. Senate passed it earlier this week. H.R. 663 was introduced in January 2023 by U.S. Democratic Representative Ruben Gallego of Arizona, and has moved through the 118th Congress with bipartisan support. The bill provides funding support for Native American tribes in treating and preventing child abuse. It would reauthorize three programs at Indian Health Services in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, created by Arizona Republican Senator John McCain in the 90s. At a September hearing, Congressman Gallego spoke to the need for the bill's passage.
We'll create a National Indian Child Resource and Family Services Center to help tribes and urban Indian organizations with training and program development. We will develop new intergovernmental agreements between tribes and states to prevent, investigate, treat, and prosecute family violence. And we will encourage culturally appropriate treatments and services for children that have been impacted.
In a press release, Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, who's vice chair of the Indian Affairs Committee, said she applauds the Senate for passing the bill. She said it is further progress towards ensuring safety for Native American children. Two other bills that address missing and murdered Indigenous people and healthcare disparities in Native communities were also advanced for further consideration in the U.S. House of Representatives. On Wednesday, we highlighted the challenge of living without electricity. Today, you'll hear from Navajo families who are getting power for the first time. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more on a life-changing program.
It's the late morning and already nearing 90 degrees in the Navajo Nation, where many homes still don't have electricity. That makes life hard.
We make a lot of grocery trips every day for like meat, frozen meat, and it's really expensive like that.
That's Persephone Blackwater. She lives in this windswept desert about 20 miles outside of the small town of Kayenta, a place where towering red mesas outnumber homes. Like many here on the reservation, Blackwater relies on a generator, but she won't have to buy another one this year. That's because a few hundred yards away, workers are using a crane-like truck with an attachment called an auger. Looks like a giant corkscrew drilling into the earth. A tall wooden power pole will be planted here to connect Blackwater to the grid. Blackwater is getting electricity thanks to Light Up Navajo, but progress has been slow. Development on remote desert land is expensive and difficult work. Over the last 5 years, the program has powered nearly 850 households, and there's still more than 13,000 that need power. Just down the road on the outskirts of Kayenta, Ryan Begay is starting to feel the benefits of having electricity, especially for his 7 kids.
They were excited, even for like having popsicles and that, you know, in a freezer.
Helen Nelson is an elder who lived most of her life without electricity. But this summer, Nelson got power. She shares her story in the Navajo language. Nelson says her life is a lot different now. Her son bought her a refrigerator, and at night, she can turn on a light if she has to use the bathroom. Nelson says she was also excited to watch TV in her home for the first time. She stayed up past midnight, laughing and feeling happy. I'm Caleb Radel.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips.